welcome to EXO 101, Introduction to Exobiology.
Hi, welcome to Lecture 6 of EXO 101, Introduction to Exobiology. Today, we will be talking about predation. So predation is one of the major feeding relationships. We've talked a little bit about this kind of subject before. A feeding relationship is all about who eats whom. The producers, or autotrophs, are those that make their own food from energy available in their environment and available base chemicals. They do not eat other organisms. The consumers, the heterotrophs, need to eat other organisms to survive. So primary consumers only eat producers. Secondary consumers eat primary consumers, tertiary consumers eat secondary consumers, and so on. And an organism can be multiple trophic levels at once. For example, if you are eating the earth delicacy known as a bacon cheeseburger, you are going to be eating a primary consumer, the cow. You are also eating an omnivore, the pig. That pig is itself a secondary consumer, and therefore you are now acting as a secondary and a tertiary consumer. If you hear any noise in the background, it is because I am recording today's lecture from a different room, and my dogs are present, so you may hear them moving around in the background. Speaking of dogs, carnivores. Carnivores are literally means meat eaters. The carn part means meat, vore means to eat. So they only eat consumers. They can be themselves secondary consumers, tertiary, quaternary, etc. But if an animal only eats, or I should say, any organism that only eats consumers is a carnivore. There are three major types, and these again are not mutually exclusive. A predator is one that hunts and kills consumers for food. A scavenger eats consumers that are found dead. This could be dead of natural causes or that were killed by a predator. A parasite that lives off of a consumer host. So the host stays alive, but it may suffer or sicken. And I should point out there are also parasites that live on producers, but they would not be considered carnivores. Omnivores eat producers and consumers, so they can be predators, scavengers, or parasites when it comes down to the part of their diet that depends on consumers. So predation specifically is the act of hunting another consumer, also known as the prey, for food. Has given rise to specialized behaviors in both predator and prey, and specialized physiology in both predator and prey, as a result of fairly intense selective pressure. Some of the behaviors that we see in predators. For solitary predators, they generally have some overwhelming physical or behavioral advantage that allows them to hunt solo and to kill often enough to stay alive. They do not need others to help with the kill. And the advantage of this is they get to keep all of what they kill, provided they can defend it. You will frequently see them eat their fill of a kill and then leave the rest for scavengers. Now, the downside is that means they have to do all the hunting by themselves, and they have to defend their kill. They have to guard it, hide it, eat it all at once, or frequently, like I mentioned, eat it and then abandon what's left. It also means they have no fallback option. If they can't hunt, they die. If they fail at hunting too often, they die. If they get hurt, you get the idea. They get to have all the food that they want, but they also don't have any backup plan. For group predators, they tend to have some sort of sophisticated means of communication and education. They need to be able to talk to each other so that they can coordinate the hunt. They also will educate the younger members of their group in how to take on their role as mature hunters when they grow up. So these guys work in a group to hunt, which also means they have to share the kill. There's often a hierarchy. Certain members will have priority to eat the food before everyone else, especially if there's not quite enough food to go around. If you're trying to decide who's going to go hungry, sometimes some of these species will have a hierarchy that determines who gets to eat less. It also makes it easier to defend their kill, so they can take down larger prey and don't have to worry about most of it going to waste because they can't eat it all at once. So they can take down a very large prey animal, eat some, then guard the rest. And as we see, more sophisticated levels of technology in these species frequently have some way of preserving it, or they'll set up watch rotations. Basically, they have more sophisticated means of making sure that their food lasts longer. It also makes it easier to defend territory. So even though you're sharing your food with many other organisms, you can kind of carve off a bigger area of territory and thus a bigger food source to share with those individuals by sharing the roles of defending it. A solo hunter can't spend a huge amount of time defending territory because otherwise then they're not hunting. They're giving up opportunities to eat in order to defend the opportunities to eat. This is not a great way to trade off their time and energy. With group predation, you can have individuals take on specialized roles. So maybe individuals that are not as good at hunting, maybe they're smaller or they're younger or they're not as well trained, they can be in charge of guarding the area while the hunters take care of that. So this gives rise to specialized roles. You will see some individuals are in charge for caring for the offspring, others doing guarding, others may be resting, some may be, if they're injured or something, they may be able to take some time off and be helped. And as I mentioned, you get more care for group members who are hurt or ill. You frequently see kill sharing. So they will share some of the meat with those even who didn't do the hunting. They'll bring some of it back for those who still need to eat. This type of predation is the one more associated with sapience. A solo hunter doesn't need to have the type of intelligence we tend to associate with sapience. But the needs for communication and sophisticated coordination that favor group predation is more likely to give rise to sapient intelligence. Now, I should point out this is not exclusive. You will sometimes see predators that alternate between one and the other. When prey is plentiful, it may make more sense to hunt on your own. Everybody for themselves, go grab what you can, and you'll be fine. There's no need for the sophistication to find rare prey. And then other times of the year, it makes sense to group together, share out the load, and so forth. The behaviors that we see in the prey also vary depending on whether they are solitary or working in groups. So solitary prey animals, again, will have to have some sort of advanced physical defenses, rapid reproduction, camouflage, speed, defenses, some way of defending themselves against predators since they're on their own. Now, it is easier to hide. It's easier to hide one organism than it is to hide a whole family. You have better freedom of movement. You also don't need as much food, so you don't have to spend as much time out getting food and exposing yourself to predation. Okay, the prey also have better freedom of movement. They don't have to coordinate their moves with other members of their species, so it's easier for them to sneak past a predator, to get to food quickly and easily, and they don't need to have as much food available per area. Especially if they're spread, their species is fairly spread out, you don't have to worry about competing for your food sources, at least with your own species. You frequently can see cross-species cooperation. This can compensate for some of the downside of being a solitary prey animal. For example, there's nobody to watch your back. So if you are eating, if you got your head down eating, you may miss the approach of a predator. Now, cross-species cooperation can take the role, for example, warning calls. On Earth, there are ecosystems where multiple species use the same warning call. They use the same notes in the same sequence, and they all understand that this is a warning. So anybody who sees a predator makes that call, and everybody knows to get out of the way. Now, whoever makes that call is taking on some risk because you're going to be the one that the predator notices. You have a higher chance of that individual being killed. But the presence of this warning call has a high enough adaptive potential. It helps individuals survive often enough that it persists in the population. Group prey animals. They have the safety in numbers. You are now safe from any except the most sophisticated and well-armed predators. An individual hawk will have a much harder time snatching a rabbit if it's in a group with other rabbits, because someone's going to see it coming. You're more likely to. Now, in order for prey animals to live in a group, you must have abundant food in that area, the same as for the predators. Since prey animals are frequently herbivores, this is going to be more successful in areas where you have high levels of water, lots of plants, lots of food to go around. You also can guard territory, so you can guard access to that food and keep watch for incoming predators. Now, the camouflage is not as helpful in these species because there's so many of them, the chances of them all hiding are lower. You frequently will see camouflage in the young, though, especially if the young have to be left on their own for periods of time. Say, while the parents are out getting food, they might need to leave the babies behind, and having a baby that can hide for a long period of time is more helpful. This is especially true if the baby is going, if the young have a period of time where they can't keep up with the adults, they can't walk as fast, or maybe they can't walk at all. If they can't follow along successfully, you need some way to have them take care of themselves while everybody else is gone. You can also have fairly sophisticated warning systems without relying on other species. Not everybody needs to be vigilant all the time, especially if they have food sharing. Now, not all group predators share food. In that case, you want to have some way of taking turns of who keeps watch versus who's eating, so you don't have individuals who are the most vigilant dying off for lack of food, because that's a great way to lose that trait in future generations. And you again, as we saw with the predators, see things like specialized roles. Some take care of the offspring, some stand guard, some find food. And as we see, this is again this kind of behavior and the kind of coordination that we tend to associate with sapiens. So the physical adaptations we see in predators take several different forms. Sensory, they need to have some way of detecting their prey. So good vision can help you see camouflaged prey. Humans are particularly good at pattern recognition, so this is something that we learned for that purpose. If you have a good sense of smell, you can track your prey over distances. If you have echolocation, you can find your prey even when it's dark. If you have sensitive hearing or taste, those can be very useful. And taste especially is helpful if you're in an aquatic environment. In an aquatic environment, the molecules that we give off will linger in the water and can be tracked. You may have heard about the sharks on Earth that can track a drop of water or a drop of blood in the water for insane distances. What they're basically doing is smelling or tasting that water. They're using chemical senses to follow that trail from a low concentration to a high concentration and find the prey. The movement adaptations are things like speed, or the ability to remain still for very long periods of time. If you're an ambush hunter, the ability to stay still for a long period of time without your muscles cramping, without having your feet go to sleep, that's very helpful. The ability to move silently, so having very fine motor control, having adaptations to things like, say, the feathers on a bird. Owls on here on Earth have feathers that are adapted so that they allow for silent flight. They don't make a lot of noise as they're swooping in on prey. Having high levels of maneuverability is particularly helpful, especially if you're chasing, if you're having to chase your prey. You will also frequently see some sort of defense, being armored against the prey fighting back. So fur, shells, scales, mucus coats, that sort of thing. This can also include immunity to poison or venom. So if there is a prey species that's poisonous, nobody else can eat it, but you can. You now have a private food source just for you. If that species tries to bite back with venom and you can withstand it, you now have a huge advantage. Offensively, you'll see some way of injuring the prey or capturing it. Claws, teeth, venom, a web, something like that. And you also will frequently see other adaptations such as, say, the ability to dig. If you can dig after prey species that might be hiding underground, that's going to be helpful. If you have claws adapted for climbing up into trees to get at prey. If you have short legs so that you can burrow down, you can crawl into burrows easily. Having long tails to manage acrobatic type movements in trees, that's all very helpful. And the list goes on. You will see when I, after I talk about the prey adaptations, you have a bit of an arms race. So we're seeing a lot of variation in the kinds of different adaptations that can be successful. There's lots of different ways to do this right. And over time, more and more will accumulate. With the prey, we have, again, sensory adaptations. They need to be able to sense predators. You hear them, see them, smell them, some way of telling that they're coming in. We on Earth, we have a bit of an arms race in terms of echolocation. So bats will use bursts of sound to find their prey, and the prey eventually evolve to hear that ping, so they know the bat's coming and they get out of the way, at which point this creates a pressure for the bats to use a different frequency, and they do. So you kind of have this ongoing back and forth as each animal is pressured to adapt by the others. We'll see movement adaptations. High degrees of speed, being able to outrun a predator is very helpful. Again, the ability to remain still. If you're hiding, if you're a camouflage-based prey animal, you can't move just because you got an itch or your foot fell asleep. Being able to move silently and avoid detection. High levels of maneuverability. The same types of adaptations we saw with the predators. Defense, same kind of things, fur, shells, scales, mucus, spines, poison, camouflage, immunities to venom, all ways of working around the adaptations that the predators have. Prey will also have their own defense, abilities to fight back. So having claws, teeth, or venom of their own can give them advantage in at least getting in either avoiding predation or getting the predator to leave them alone in the first place. Just a note, the difference between poison and venom, this is something people get backwards frequently. If you eat it and you die, it was poisonous. If it bites you and you die, it was venomous. So venom is something that is injected into what you bite. Poison is something that's in your body that keeps things from biting you. You'll also see other adaptations such as digging or climbing, same as with the predators. The ability to fly or glide to get away from a predator that can't do that. That's very helpful. Decoy coloration is a fun one. We see this in prey. This is one of the few adaptations you're going to see in the prey that you don't really see in the predator. So you might want to look like a different prey species that is, for example, poisonous. This means you don't have to go through all the metabolic problems of making a poison and storing it in your body. You can just look like something that's poisonous and everybody leaves you alone. That's a huge adaptation. So, as I mentioned, we have an arms race. Each new adaptation that appears in one side or the other creates pressure on everybody else. So, if let's say you have that, and that means others in your group, the predator or prey, have to keep up. So, if you have a prey animal that is now poisonous and is obvious about it, that creates pressure on the other prey animals to either hide better, mimic the poisonous one, or do something to avoid becoming now the preferred food source. If you have a predator that's faster and stronger and better at catching prey, the other predators are going to starve unless they can keep up. And this is where those mimics come from on the defense side. The other group needs countermeasures now. The faster predator means that the prey needs to be a little faster to survive, or has to get better at hiding, or better at outmaneuvering something, some way of counteracting the adaptation from the other group. And this cycle will keep repeating. So over time, you will have species that have these immense suites of adaptations to survive their opposition. And this just keeps building up over time. What's interesting is sometimes we can infer the presence of an ancestral predator or prey animal based on adaptations we see now. So if you have two species that adapt to one another very well, and one of those species eventually dies off, the adaptations may still linger in the other group. For example, the Coromar have an immunity to a particular toxin that is found only in a very small population of this particular prey herbivore. But that that animal does not live in on the main continent where the rest of the Koromar are. It's only found on a couple of small islands off the shore. The fossil record says that that animal used to live on the main continent, but it no longer does. Now, whether this is due to predation or due to climate change or something else, we're not entirely sure. We don't have full information. This is based on some very early biology texts that we got from the Koromar that were from a very long time ago, and we haven't gotten anything recently. Because the Koromar, as you know, do not release information about their planet or their biology or anything, really. But it does imply that the Koromar at one point had evolved a resistance to this toxin so that they could use this prey animal as food, and have maintained that immunity even now that that prey animal is no longer a food source. So a lot of times when we're looking at sapient and sentient species, we can see sophisticated skills that had a root in the predation relationship, which is why we're having a discussion about it as its own interaction today. Group communication, for example. If you're trying to coordinate a hunt, you need some way of communicating what to do to your allies, deciding who's going to approach from which angle, who's going to hide, who's going to drive the prey. That all needs to be communicated somehow. The complex social structures that we generally associate with sapients have parallels in what we see in even non-sapient group predators and group preys. The ability to have multiple roles carried out at the same time gives a massive advantage to that species. Also, the willingness to care for young that are not yours. This comes from the practice we see in these more sophisticated, specialized groups of having some individuals whose job it is to care for all of the young, even if they are not blood relatives. This fosters an empathy that allows that species to now live as a group, to consider each other honorary family, even if you are not blood kin, and can give rise to more complex civilizations. Strategic thinking is very helpful. The ability to plan for the future, the ability to allocate food resources, to figure out, okay, how often do we need to hunt? How much food are we going to need? Who's going to do which jobs? All of that kind of strategic thinking is very helpful that gives you the ability to now form more complex societies. And the neurological adaptations, the ability to process complex visual images, to recognize patterns, and how to foil that recognition, are all things that help for sapient thought. And when the pressure to hunt or the pressure from being hunted is removed, the adaptations will stick around. And it's not just physiological, like with the toxin resistance. So a lot of times the impulses need to be redirected. For example, a lot of species that used to be hunters now have some form of sport that mimics those same skills. Something where they will work together as a group to accomplish a goal, chase down something, an excuse to run, to jump, to catch, to basically satisfy the urges that come along with that lifestyle, even though they no longer need to do that for food. And there is some speculation that war, especially wars that are not fought for survival, may be a side effect of the predatory, or I should say, not necessarily predatory, because some of the fiercest warriors are, in fact, prey animals. That war is that territorial instinct combined with higher levels of technology and turned outward. So the willingness to have organized groups defending a territory or hunting down a foe bears a lot of resemblance to behaviors we see in predators and prey. But the fact is that, you know, it's no longer for the reasons it once was, you know, doesn't change necessarily where that behavior came from. So understanding the roots of these behaviors can go a long way towards understanding why species will go to war and the best ways to help them avoid this. And as members of this school, you will very likely be playing a role as a moderator or a diplomat. Teachers no longer just educate. We have been tasked with many capacities with helping communication between groups who don't normally communicate well together. And understanding that some of the impulses that individuals deal with may be very, very old. And we see this in many species. So, understanding this in yourself is important as well. All right, so that's it for today. As usual, please go ahead and take a look at the class website. That it is at patreon.com/bekernwrites. If you would like to follow me on Twitter, I am at bekernwrites. I also, the website for this work and others, including some of my writing, is bekernwrites.com. And I look forward to seeing you next time.
EXO 101 is the property of Brendan E. Kern and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. I tweet at B.E. Kern Writes, and I can be emailed at bekernwrites@gmail.com. The intro and outro music are Brittle Rill by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com and are licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 License. This and other works can be found at my website, bekernwrites.com. My work is supported by Patreon. You can become a patron at patreon.com/bekernwrites.